You're listening to a recording from the 2017 Gospel Coalition National Conference.
So just a little disclaimer, when I sent in the description to the Gospel Coalition 6 or 8 or 9 months ago, I just made that up, and So I'm not sure how closely this is going to follow the letter of that description, but hopefully it will follow the spirit. So, Citizen Kane has his rosebud for Charlie of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. It's a golden ticket. And Winston Smith in George Orwell's 1984 has a beautiful piece of pink coral in a heavy glass paperweight. Each of these objects is for their possessor an emblem of their vision of the good life. Literature and real life are both filled with such emblems that represent the attainment of our greatest longings. For Willie Loman and Arthur Miller's Death of a Salesman, it's a pair of green velvet slippers. Willie Loman leads the quintessential American life, characteristic of what Henry David Thoreau meant when he wrote a century earlier that the mass of men lead lives of quiet desperation. Willie's desperation is cloaked in the glossy veneer of the American dream, beneath which, however, we find an empty, corrupted version of a once honorable ideal. When the play opens, Willie is dying. His memory is failing. He constantly tells his sons that the key to success in life is being well-liked. But as his appearances decline and his old contacts disappear, Willie's sales diminish and his failures increase until he is fired and his world crashes. The title of the work has two references within the play, and they are inextricably linked. The first is the ending, and spoiler alert, the salesman dies. The other reference is found in passing in the play. It's a story within the story, kind of like that piece of pink coral inside Winston Smith's glass paperweight. The story that Willie tells is of Dave Singleman, a salesman Willie had met many years before when Dave was an elderly man at 84 and Willie was a young man. And Willie, when he tells the story, he says that Dave Singleman would, quote, put on his green velvet slippers and pick up his phone and call the buyers, and without ever leaving his room, he made his living. Beholden to a vision for success that belonged to someone else, Willie decided at that time that selling was the greatest career a man could want. Notice that word, want. What could be more satisfying, he asks. For when Dave Singleman died all those years ago, Willie says, he died the death of a salesman. In his green velvet slippers in the smoker of the New York, New Haven, and Hartford, going into Boston. When he died, hundreds of salesmen and buyers were at his funeral. So for Willie, the velvet green slippers symbolize the attainment of his deepest longing to be well-liked. This is the desire formed in Willie's imagination, conscripted within him more and more deeply over time as he lives his life according to the habits and rituals of a corrupted American dream, one marked by shiny cars, new appliances, and whipped cheese in a can. But this false vision of the good life that drives him for the rest of his life ultimately drives him to his death. As the vision falters, and with it, Willie's own moral imagination, Willie emerges from one of his reveries into the past with the sudden realization that in his life, nothing's planted. He says, I don't have a thing in the ground. He rushes off to get some seeds. His son Biff finds him outside later, late at night, planting the seeds. The action is emblematic. It's not literal seeds that Willie has neglected to plant, but the seeds of enduring, real values that he realizes only now he has failed to implant in his sons. At one point near the end of the play, Biff says to Willie, "We never told the truth for 10 minutes in this house." And Biff goes on to tell Willie that Willie had blown Biff so full of hot air while he was growing up, the hot air of unrealistic expectations and false illusions, that Biff never realizes the difference between a false vision and a true one until it is almost too late. Finally, Biff realizes that all I want is out there waiting for me the minute I know who I am. Why did Willie's life as a salesman constitute the pursuit of a false dream? Because, as the play makes clear, Willie suppressed his true nature and sold himself out to become something he wasn't called to be. As we learn from various revelations in the play, it wasn't making sales that made Willie happy. It was making things with his hands. Reflecting upon Willie's self-inflicted death, his son Biff remarks, "There were a lot of nice days. When he'd come home from a trip, or on Sundays, making the stoop, finishing the cellar, putting on the new porch, when he built the bedroom and put up the garage, there's more of him in that front stoop than in all the sales he made." After Willie's death, immediately following his funeral, Willie's son Biff says of him, "He had the wrong dreams, all wrong. He never knew who he was. The man didn't know who he was." And in not knowing who he was, Willie bought into a false vision of what it was he should become. Death of a Salesman is one of my favorite plays to teach to my college students. The college students are in one of the most vulnerable places in life, in that liminal space between dependence and independence, between adolescence and adulthood. They come to college thinking they are possessed of a vision of the good life. But more often than not, it is a vision they have merely received, not one they have co-created. They do not know who they are. Who they think they are is usually a collage of fragments formed from parental expectations, peer influences, and increasingly, of course, social media, and decreasingly, the church. But the work of their own moral imaginations, through exposure to great ideas and great books, helps them, as it helps all of us, to achieve the knowledge vital to casting a vision for the good life that has been fitted for each of us by our Creator. My literary and spiritual memoir, from which this part of the paper I just read is drawn, Booked: Literature and the Soul of Me, examines the way visions of the good life were implanted in me by great books. So from Great Expectations, I learned the power of stories we tell ourselves, and how they can do us either harm or good to others or ourselves. From Madame Bovary, I learned to embrace the real world rather than escaping into unsustainable and unrealistic romanticism. From Gulliver's Travels, I learned the profound limitations of my own finite perspective. And from Tess of the D'Urbervilles, I saw the power of grace and the tragedy of its absence. And from Gerard Manley Hopkins, the 19th century poet, I came to love the pied beauty of the world and in me because of the one who created these. But these aren't mere intellectual or moral lessons, although they certainly may begin as such. Rather, the stories and images from these books and so many others show us the practices that lead toward or away from the good life. Virtues, according to Aristotle, are the moderation between the vices of excess and deficiency. They manifest within us, within the context of a given situation, a practiced response to whatever great good or great ill a life, a day, an hour, or a moment might bring. The good life, therefore, does not depend upon the absence of suffering, pain, ill, or wrong, but is the constant practice of making up for loss, not with excess, but with the graceful mean that restores balance and harmony. It's really just a way of living out Philippians 4:5, rendered in the King James, "Let your moderation be known unto all men." Virtue is acquired through both knowledge and practice. Pr- practices are the patterns we put ourselves through every day, every year, through a lifetime. As James K.A. Smith has shown in Desiring the Kingdom and Imagining the Kingdom, and his newest book, which condenses both of those into You Are What You Love, he shows how practices become habits, habits become virtues, and ultimately virtues become who we are and what we love. Specifically, in Imagining the Kingdom, Smith explains that imagination is fundamentally aesthetic or sensory in nature. As human beings' meaning-making faculty, imagination is the force that presses us, literally, making impressions on us and in us. Being made in the image of God, the process of imaging or imagining is a simultaneous and reciprocal receiving and sending forth. In other words, imagination is both mimetic and generative. We imitate and we create in using the imagination. Without imagination, we are mere animals, worms living out our days in the dark. Good books tap into the powers of imagination to allow us to picture the possibilities, both bright and dark, for our human existence, possibilities we might not otherwise know. Literature makes concrete, it embodies or incarnates the abstractions of ideas and ideals. The world's literary masterpieces provide a formative classroom. In holding forth visions of the good life, great literature cultivates desire for that good life. Furthermore, reading such literature is a practice that cultivates virtue as the reader inhabits the world of the book and exercises vicariously the choices and actions embedded in that world. As C.S. Lewis famously observed, "We are half-hearted creatures, fooling around with drink and sex and ambition when infinite joy is offered us like an ignorant child who wants to go on making mud pies in a slum because he cannot imagine what is meant by the offer of a holiday at the sea. We are far too easily pleased." In other words, what Lewis is saying is we cannot desire what we cannot imagine, and we cannot imagine what we have not seen. This is why, again from Jamie Smith, he explains that imagination precedes desire because actions are pulled out of us according to our vision of the good life and what it means to be human. We first imagine what we ought to love, Smith argues, because significance for creatures like us is first and foremost incarnate. And if you don't believe this, then just simply watch television for an hour and see this is how commercials work. They are implanting desires in us by placing images before us. And if it didn't work, they wouldn't sell Super Bowl commercials for as much money as they do. Willie himself got this vision of the good life that he saw in symbolized by those green velvet slippers. Smith uses the metaphor of conscription to describe the way in which we are recruited to visions of the good life apart from our conscious choosing. It's not a question of whether you're being conscripted to some vision of the good life. It's which vision of the good life. And there are many false visions of the good life out there. But the human imagination is more than just a picture-making function. Language is inextricably bound to the working of the imagination. Imagination is, after all, the expression of the Creator showing forth his image in his creation. To imagine is to mirror God, the Word, in us. Imagination is the bridge between Word and world. Through imagination, a mere picture becomes an idea expressed in words, which then becomes a way of being and acting in the world. And although words can be used to lie, as Satan, the father of lies, does, there is something inherent in language that leads toward truth. As the Reformers understood, the word, capital W word, and words depend in their very function and effect on an inherent logic, a rationality, a linearity, and an order that isn't quite as essential to images. This may be why, as a recent essay that I stumbled across in the Financial Times, of all places, argues, there is something that tends toward conservatism in literature in a way that is not found in the other arts. Quote, a dark view of humans, a certain resignation to the imperfectibility of things, is what marks literature out from the idealistic arts, the essay states. This conservatism that seems part of the nature of literary art is, quote, something more like a skeptical habit of mind and a preference for dismal truths over well-meaning lies, which is what political correctness often amounts to. So while most non-conservative schemes, social democracy, the wilder edges of identity politics, this is all from the article, are efforts to redefine or deny that nature through bureaucratic tinkering, the writer of good literature must believe that human nature is universal and more or less unchangeable, end quote. Yet, while human nature is unchanging, the world we live in and the sense we must endeavor to make of it is always shifting. In an important essay by Graham Ward in the Oxford Journal Literature and Theology called How Literature Resists Secularity, Ward states, human beings do not just live in the world, they produce it. He goes on to explain that the human ability to imagine goes beyond mere mimesis or mimicking when it starts to create or to fashion. Books change us, Ward explains, because reading is one of the various practices that form, transform, and refigure subjectivities and knowledges of self and world, informing the soul and writing upon the body. And then Ward declares, in defiance, really, of every fashionable post-structuralist, deconstructive, politically correct, and utterly desacralized view of literature that now reigns in the academy, he says, there are books that have changed people's lives. That's a radical statement in today's postmodern culture, and anybody who's studied literature in the secular academy knows how radical that is. And I agree with Ward because they've changed mine. But in recent decades, as the concept of the good life has fallen away, for who can define what's good anyway, so too has the idea of great books, for who can judge what constitutes greatness. I mean, this has been a debate within the English Academy since the 80s, pretty much, exploding the canon, the Western canon. So if this is the case, if we don't know what good is and we can't define great because it's all subjective, then why study books at all? Gary Saul Morrison, a professor at Northwestern University who teaches Russian literature in classes that seat hundreds of students, this is elective classes, it's a miracle, published an essay not long ago in Commentary titled, Why College Kids Are Avoiding the Study of Literature. Resisting the easy assumption that the problem is kids today, Morrison points instead to the way the current teaching of literature has tended to cut out all the pounds of flesh and to leave only the bones. Students no longer desire to read, Morrison argues, not because they don't desire wisdom and guidance toward the good life, but because they don't see reading books as a source for this. When all that's required by most educators today, when all that's required can be gleaned from skimming the Wikipedia or SparkNotes summary, the form and practice of reading itself is neglected. Focusing on the technical aspects of literature as mere craft, or on abstract literary theories, or on judgment of the text, a text from the past by present day ideas, which is constitutes all of the common approaches to teaching literature today, or on context, historical context, at the expense of the text, all of these approaches serve to diminish, Morrison says, the way the author creates an experience for the reader. And I'm going to read a pretty long quote from him, but I think it's very helpful. Morrison says, it is really quite remarkable what happens when reading a great novel. By identifying with a character, you learn from within what it feels like to be someone else.
Reading a novel, you experience the perceptions, values, and quandaries of a person from another epoch, society, religion, social class, culture, gender, or personality type. By practice, we learn what it is like to perceive, experience, and evaluate the world in various ways. This is the very opposite of measuring people in terms of our values. To be sure, there are other disciplines that sometimes tell us we should empathize, but only literature offers constant practice in doing so. We follow the life of Dorothea Brooke or David Copperfield moment to moment, and we live with them for hundreds of hours, always living into their experience, growing along with them, approving or disapproving their choices, and perhaps changing our minds as they change theirs. This long process offers a lot of practice and empathy, enough to make it a habit. Students will acquire the skill to inhabit the author's world. Her perspective becomes one with which they are intimate and which, when their own way of thinking leads them to a dead end, they can temporarily adopt to see if it might help. Novelistic empathy gives them a diversity of ways of thinking and feeling. They can escape from the prison house of self, end quote. So it's not just what great books tell us that leads to the good life, it's how they tell us. So for example, as we read in Pride and Prejudice about Elizabeth Bennet, we also read with her. As we see through her eyes her first impressions, which was the original title that she gave to Pride and Prejudice, even in the 19th century, writers didn't get to assign titles. Editors did. Please know that. If you leave here knowing one thing, know that editors write titles, not writers. That gets me into a lot of trouble sometimes. So as we see through her eyes, her first impressions, we misread along with her the character of Mr. Darcy. We are duped into trusting Elizabeth's perspective because it seems to us and to her that she is so eminently trustworthy, admiring, as we should, her keen insight, because she does have that, it's just simply not infallible, admiring her sharp wit and her self-assurance, we take pride in our judgment, as Elizabeth does in hers, only to find that very pride comes before a fall. Recoiling with her at Mr. Darcy's unmistakable pride, we turn out to be, like her, prejudiced. A little flip-flop going on there. So reading this novel is an act of meta-reading. It is reading about reading, reading about misreading, a lesson in hermeneutical humility, as is all literary reading. This is why the way we read can be even more important than what we read. In explaining the inherently religious nature of literature, going back to Graham Ward again, Ward explains that both the act of writing and the act of reading, like the act of religious piety, involve practices of believing. Metaphors not only transport, Ward writes, they transfigure. They don't just move us, they change us. The most literary of literary reading is most likely the kind of reading most of us read least of all, poetry. So I'm going to give a few minutes to poetry here. As the form of literature that uses language in its most condensed form, poetry magnifies the power that all literary art has to break down the walls of what Morrison calls this prison house of self. Poetry binds likeness to likeness, word to music, image to sensation. While the rest of the world divides and derides, pushes away and pushes apart, confronts and affronts, poetry brings together. While the world spots differences, poetry seeks semblances. It is, one might say, I hope this isn't too sacrilegious, but a ministry of reconciliation. A ministry of weaving a fractured fallen world back together, word by word. Of gathering up scattered pieces of brokenness and gluing them back together again, like a cracked china cup in which meaning is served to overflowing. Consider the astonishing insights of this Walt Whitman poem, which compares the human soul in a state of existential and spiritual angst wrought by the modern condition to a spider. Now bear with me, I'm going to read a poem. A noiseless, patient spider. I marked where on a little promontory it stood, isolated. Marked how to explore the vacant, vast surrounding. It launched forth filament, filament, filament out of itself, ever unreeling them, ever tirelessly speeding them. And you, O my soul, where you stand, surrounded, detached in measureless oceans of space, ceaselessly musing, venturing, throwing, seeking the spheres to connect them to the bridge you will need to be formed, till the ductile anchor hold, till the gossamer thread you fling catch somewhere, O my soul. There is far more to say about this poem than I can manage here, but what is notable for this discussion is how even an unbelieving, humanistic transcendentalist like Walt Whitman can see and express such truth by allowing the language of poetry to do what it is designed to do, to make connections. The poem shows the parallels between the self-made filament of the spider, that creature's tenuous connection to the world, and the musing, venturing, throwing, and seeking of the modern soul, unmoored from traditional truth and authority, merely a gossamer thread to fling ceaselessly until it connects. The language of poetry and song, of rhyme and verse, comes naturally to us, as anyone who has a small child knows. But unlike spoken language, reading does not come naturally to human beings. It must be taught. It must be practiced. Because it goes beyond mere biology, there is something profoundly spiritual about the human ability and impulse to read. In fact, even the various senses in which we use the word read captures this. To read means not only to decipher a given and learned set of symbols in a mechanistic way, but it also suggests that very human act of finding meaning, of interpreting, in the sense of reading a person or reading a situation. To read in this sense might be considered one of the most spiritual of all human activities, inasmuch as it allows us to transcend the immediacy of the material and of the moment at hand. Through imagination, great books allow us to behold characters, places, situations, and ideas far beyond where our bodies can take us. In this way, great books expand our communities and thereby expand the possibilities of our visions for the good life. Thus, reading literary writing, that is, writing that uses language artistically so that it both teaches and delights, has a socializing or humanizing effect on us. In fact, more and more studies confirm that emotional intelligence, empathy, and social perception are measurably improved after test subjects read literary fiction in particular. Researchers attribute this outcome to the role the imagination plays in reading literary works. Reading requires our minds to make inferences, interpret nuanced indicators, gauge emotions, and predict outcomes, just as we must do in real life. In emphasizing showing rather than telling, literary texts require readers to do more interpretive work in discerning the meaning of a story. Such activity recreates the interpretive work we do as we interact with people, reading them, and reading situations we find ourselves in every day, all day. Furthermore, studies in neuroscience, psychology, and cognitive science show that what they call deep reading, or slow, immersive reading, rich in sensory detail and emotional and moral complexity, is a distinctive experience among humans. So these are, you know, people who don't know that we're made in the image of God necessarily, but they see something different. It's a kind of reading that differs in kind and quality from the mere decoding of words, which constitutes a good deal of what passes for reading in this digital age. One literary critic, Frank Kermode, distinguishes between what he calls carnal reading, which is the kind of hurried, utilitarian information gathering that we do when we're just reading to get data or facts. And that constitutes for most of us the bulk of our daily reading diet. And what he calls spiritual reading, reading done with focused attention for pleasure, reflection, analysis, and growth. Thus, great books expand the moral imagination not only by enlarging our field of vision beyond the limits of finite experience, but also by helping us to practice finding and making meaning. While mathematics, philosophy, and psychology are also endeavors in making sense out of the universe, several characteristics of literary fiction reflect the human condition in ways distinct to storytelling. Stories take place in linear time and thus imitate our sense of our earthly existence, which also has a beginning, middle, and end. Even stories that play with linear time, still in playing with it, are rooted in the concept of linearity. Further, the heart of every story is conflict. Without a conflict and the events that lead to and follow from it, there is no story, but merely a series of events. The center of a story, the conflict, is the very phenomenon that creates our need as human beings to make meaning out of our lives. For conflict lies at the heart of the ultimate story of human existence, creation, fall, and redemption. And the essential human conflict, of course, is the rupture of our union with God. Stories embody truth in a way that parallels the incarnation. Because literature embodies the linearity and connectivity of our conflict-ridden lives, reading is a practice in making meaning out of the human condition. Metaphorically, stories, dramas, and poetry put flesh on ideas so that they can dwell among us. It is this kind of spiritual reading, not merely decoding, that unleashes the power that good literature has to reach into our souls, and in so doing, draw and connect us to others. And as, again, Graham Ward argues, all literary reading is spiritual. The persuasiveness of literature, what the poet Samuel Coleridge describes as poetic faith, Ward says, leaves an indelible imprint upon our emotional capacity to respond and our imaginative capacity to empathize. And as Jamie Smith describes it in Imagining the Kingdom, quote, perception is already an evaluation that primes me to act in certain ways. The person with good character has herself or been taught by those around her to see situations in the right way. Of course, no image of the good life is possible apart from a vision of the good of others. This truth is reflected in the very nature of the triune God, whose own nature bespeaks community and whose creative act in making humankind formed us for fellowship with him and with one another. So while a good life requires a sense of oneself, the vision for the good life cannot be centered on one's own life. But rather, the truly good life requires us to imagine our place within a community. As John Donne so memorably reminds us in Meditation 17, written in reflection upon the death of an anonymous fellow citizen, no man is an island entire of itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. If a clod be washed away by the sea, Europe is the less. And then, as his meditation goes on in a particularly apt metaphor, it's not quoted as often, but it's my favorite part of this meditation, Donne compares all of humanity to a book. Another long quote, bear with me, but it's Donne, so. All mankind is of one author and is one volume. When one man dies, one chapter is not torn out of the book, but translated into a better language. And every chapter must be so translated. God employs several translators. Some pieces are translated by age, some by sickness, some by war, some by justice. But God's hand is in every translation, and his hand shall bind up all our scattered leaves again for that library where every book shall lie open to one another. Death reminds Donne and us that we are all pages of one book. And so perhaps the best vision for the good life, which is but one page in a great book, begins with the knowledge of death, with knowledge of the inevitability of death and the limit of our mortal frame and earthly existence. To know that we will surely die can guide us in knowing how to live. There may be no book more fit to explore this than Leo Tolstoy's short novel, which is really also a long parable, The Death of Ivan Illich. The story begins with the announcement of Ivan Illich's death at age 45. But the family and colleagues who soon gather do not see death in this death. Rather, they see only how their lives are affected by the event, their inconveniences, their anticipated advancements, their unwanted social obligations. Indeed, the story says, each one thought or felt, well, he's dead, but I'm alive. Such, too, had Illich's blindness been, as we learn in the first sentence of the second chapter. Quote, Ivan Illich's life had been most simple and most ordinary, and therefore most terrible. The narrator then takes us through Ivan's life, his schooling, his career success, his marriage, fatherhood, all carried out according to the routine of secular ritual, in accordance to a received vision of how a successful life should go, one, quote, easily, pleasantly, and decorously lived. It is, in fact, while decorating that Ivan suffers his literal and metaphorical fall. In a sumptuous new home arrived at in consequence of one more career advancement, Ivan becomes seized by the task of adorning the place. So while hanging his new drapery, he slips and falls, bruising his side. Weeks and months pass, one symptom leads to another. The doctors are unable to arrive at a diagnosis. Pain takes over, and Ivan's ability to take pleasure in the life he has worked so hard to achieve diminishes. In response to his illness, his wife and daughter muster only feelings of annoyance. In the face of his family's indifference, Ivan begins to feel hate. His physical pain increases, as too his spiritual and emotional anguish that nothing he has achieved in his life means anything. As his condition worsens, he discovers, rather accidentally, that his pain is alleviated by his servant holding up his legs. This common peasant, Gerasim, is the only kind, compassionate person in Ivan's life and in his death. As death draws near, Ivan's torments increase. Opium helps some of his physical suffering, but there seems to be no relief from his spiritual anguish. One night he cries out in anger to the God he has ignored his entire life. Why hast thou done all this? Why hast thou brought me here? Why dost thou torment me so terribly? And in imagination, he began to recall the best moments of his pleasant life. But strange to say, none of those best moments of his pleasant life now seemed at all what they had seemed then. It is as if I had been going downhill while I imagined I was going up. And that is really what it was. I was going up in public opinion, but to the same extent, life was ebbing away from me. And now it is all done, and there is only death. One night, gazing into Gerasim's face, Ivan suddenly wonders, what if my whole life has been wrong? In facing this question, his mental sufferings become even worse than his physical pain. For the last three days of his life, Ivan screams. In the midst of this, 2 hours before his death, he finally asks himself, but what is the right thing? And upon asking this question, quote, he felt that someone was kissing his hand. He opened his eyes, looked at his son, and felt sorry for him. His wife came up to him and he glanced at her. She was gazing at him open-mouthed with undried tears on her nose and cheek and a despairing look on her face. He felt sorry for her too. And suddenly it grew clear to him that what had been oppressing him and would not leave him was all dropping away at once from two sides, from 10 sides, and from all sides. He was sorry for them. He must act so as not to hurt them, release them, and free himself from these sufferings. How good and how simple, he thought. And the pain, he asked himself, what has become of the pain? Where are you, pain? He turned his attention to it. Yes, here it is. Wait, well, what of it? Let the pain be. And death, where is it? He sought his former accustomed fear of death and did not find it. Where is it? What death? There was no fear because there was no death. In place of death, there was light. So that's what it is, he suddenly exclaimed aloud. What joy! To him, all this happened in a single instant, and the meaning of that instant did not change. For those present, his agony continued for another 2 hours. Something rattled in his throat. His emaciated body twitched. Then the gasping and rattle became less and less frequent. It is finished, said someone near him. He heard these words and repeated them in his soul. Death is finished, he said to himself. It is no more. He drew in a breath, stopped in the midst of a sigh, stretched out, and died. These are the last words of the story. In death, Ivan Ilyich finds his vision for the good life. Indeed, he finds life itself. It happens that my most recent rereading of this story took place amidst intimations of mortality in my own life. I think I am like most of us in wanting to shield myself from the intimate, uncomfortable, and messy processes that mark the ending stages of life. We live in a culture that keeps death, dying, and aging as far from most of us as we can for as long as possible. Geography often separates us from the aging of our elders and medical science from that of ourselves. I have been given the gift, however, of having my aging parents brought back into close proximity, and with them, the bodily presence of the sight, sound, sense, and servitude of illness and aging. And so it happened that the day before I bore witness, helpless witness to my father's groanings in a hospital bed, I had only just reread the pages of Ivan Ilyich's last fear and scream-filled days. Reading those pages prepared me for something I didn't know I needed to be prepared for. Facing something terrible, I could behold something less terrible, something good even, because I knew from reading The Death of Ivan Ilyich that it is a terrible but wonderful thing that binds all of humanity together, the bearing of one another's burdens. My father is well now, by the way. But one day he, like all of us here, won't be. Death will come, and when he does, he will not be a stranger. Death is the shadow that has trailed us all our days, come round to meet us at the front door, and no lock can keep him forever. How we die will depend on how we live, as The Death of Ivan Ilyich and so many other works of great literature can help us to see. For those of us who profess Christ, the vision that shapes our habits, practices, and virtues in pursuit of the good life is not a rosebud stamped on a sled, or a golden ticket to a factory of delights, or a pair of green velvet slippers. It is one that more closely resembles the image of a servant who, by tending the feet of others, bears their suffering. Thank you.